Well, thank everybody for coming out on this Sunday morning. It's really exciting to be here. And thank you to David for inviting me. This was it was really wonderful to have him in class because he always knew what questions to ask and really turned around the discussion, which was wonderful. So today I want to talk about the Civil War and how people dealt with the massive death toll in the Civil War. My own work has been on the Reconstruction era right afterwards, and I'm working on some of the terrible deaths right after the Civil War, so there's more to come in the Reconstruction era. But the Civil War was a time when the United States, people in the United States, North and South, had to really deal with death on a daily basis. It became a central part of their culture. And in the 19th century, the people in the United States were really rethinking the meaning of death, in part in response to some of the terrible atrocities and deaths in the war. So I want to talk a little bit about how the war made us rethink death in the United States, in some ways which I think still are operative today. I mean, in a certain sense, the 19th century was a time when our conceptions of death and heaven became what they now are, right? Which is very different than how they thought about it in the 1700s. So I want to talk, first of all, for a little bit about what death looked like in the antebellum period. In that period before the war, how would people die and what were people expecting from death and what did they want from death? How did they try to make sense of death? About 85-90% of people in the years before the Civil War, the couple decades before the Civil War, were dying in their own homes, right? You would expect, unless you had a terrible accident, right? Or unless you were very poor and had to be in a poorhouse or a hospital, which was like a poorhouse, right? Nobody would go to an institution to die unless they were very poor. So almost everybody would die in their own home. And there were rituals that were around this death because this death could often be very terrible, right? There weren't the kind of drugs that we have now that help to alleviate some of the sufferings at the end of death or, dull the consciousness of the process of death on the part of the person who was dying. And they're surrounded by all of their family members. And they're in either their own bedroom, right, or they're in a public room. They might die in the kind of living room or parlor of the home, or in their own, and they'd be there for maybe a long, long time as they're going through that death process. And that death process could involve a lot of pain. The death process could involve a lot of terror, right? And the family members were right there, and there was nothing to be done about it, right? And so, as a consequence of that process, people had to go through. There was a lot of ritual that developed around death and a lot of emphasis. Well, and the other thing to think about at this time is that a lot of people who were dying young. Even before the war, there was a lot of, a lot of childhood death. The death rate for babies was great, right? And really you couldn't count. Often before the Civil War, people wouldn't even name their babies until they got to be about a year old because they didn't want to get too attached to them, right? So all sorts of people were dying in the home, and so people had to find ways to make sense of that. And so some of the rituals that you would practice in your home to try to deal with this is you would try to prepare the person, and the person would try to prepare themselves for a good death. And what was a good death? A lot of people talked about a good death in the 19th century. A good death was a death in which the person who was dying was conscious of their fate, knew what was going on with their death fully, was in no way evading the reality of their coming death. They were resigned to their fate and had embraced their coming death, that it was important that people had said, "I am ready to die. I'm prepared for this." That needed to be a sort of positive statement, that death no longer holds a terror for me, right? They had to say that they believed in God. For a good death, the person dying would need to express their faith, right, and say they believed in God and they had full expectation of their own salvation. They would, as the death approached more closely, they would be surrounded by family members. Somebody would be on watch all the time with the person who was dying, some family member. And then as death approached imminently, all of the family who could come would be surrounding them in their home. And those people, for those people who were surrounding them, the person who was dying would have messages that they would give to them. They would give them advice for the future. They would, talk to them about, how important they were to them. But they would. It was very important, sort of ritualistically, that one leave messages and give messages to all the people who are there. And if there's somebody who couldn't be there, a distant brother, something like that, that you would leave a message for that person to be given to them after your death. So if a loved one died, you would expect a letter that would say, "She says to you," and would write it down. So this sort of last message was a really important part of making sense of this death. And part of how this worked was that through these last messages that people were able to create a narrative, a sort of story of the meaning of that person's life in which their death was a part. There's a reason that they're dying at this moment. And through their last words and their explanations, they're telling us and helping us to create a sort of story of what their life meant and, who they have been in our circles, in our community, right? So these last moments were, and these last days were extremely important in that process. And they were also extremely important in the desire to believe that people would be reunited with this person in the next life, right, in heaven. So it was important to get that evidence that this relationship would be reformed later on in heaven. Another thing which was a really important aspect of that good death was that people would get some sort of memento of the person. And people who are interested in the 19th century are probably aware of these memento mori, these kind of mementos of death, that when a person died, you get a piece of their hair. You cut off some of their hair. You would get some sort of object, usually often it was hair, but some sort of a brooch, right? Something like that, which was associated with them. Some people may even have that in their attic, right? From like a 19th century, if you're lucky enough, I have some of these things from my family, that they keep in their family as a sort of physical representation of the person who is no longer there, right? And you'd make jewelry out of the hair, and you do things like that so that you could keep that with you, maybe wear it on your person. And also at the very end of the antebellum period, so right before the Civil War, you can start to take pictures of those people, right? And you could take pictures after they die, which they often did. And so pictures actually, from the very beginning, even before the Civil War, photographs really were very much associated with death, right? Photographs were a way to take hold of something that would no longer you could see in life. So this was what death was meant to be. This was the best that we could make of death under the circumstances we had before the Civil War. And the Civil War, of course, is going to radically change the circumstances in which people die and the frequency with which people die, right? 620,000 American soldiers would die between 1861 and 1865, so in the war, 620,000 American soldiers died. Most of those soldiers, as most people who work, know anything about this era, know most of the soldiers died of disease, right? You're about three times more likely to die of disease than to die in battle, right? But it was just as terrible. Who's gonna say what death is more terrible? But most people died of disease. Which was at least slower than many death battles, battle deaths. If we want to get a sense of how many people died at this time, it was six times the death rate that we experienced in the Second World War in this country. So six times the World War II death rate compared to our population. And it wasn't evenly distributed at all, right? In the South, there was three times the portion of the population died in the South and in the North in the war. Nor were deaths, war-related deaths, only on the battlefield. Recently, historians have been focused a lot on civilian deaths surrounding the war, which were great. We don't have really good numbers for that because part of what happened is that government broke down, particularly in the South where most of the deaths were, and records weren't kept, right? Which was what was causing some of the deaths and also kept us from recording them. But, many civilians died in the war, whether in the massive guerrilla fighting around the sides of the war, particularly in the borderlands, huge amount of guerrilla fighting, but also a lot of civilians died of diseases unleashed by the war, right? Smallpox, a whole host of yellow fever, malaria, a whole host of terrible diseases. And people died by being displaced from the war. A lot of people, when you had to move because of the movement of the armies, right, or because some people tried to follow their husbands because that was supporting them, that was their source of financial support. For whatever reason, a lot of civilians were made refugees during the war, and refugees died at a tremendous rate, both because they were packed into camp and therefore had to, were more susceptible to disease, also because they weren't eating well enough, right? And they just didn't have their support structure in place. And these deaths of refugees, in some ways, were particularly terrible because the people who tended to die as refugees would be the youngest, right, the oldest, and women who were pregnant. Right, so people who were already sick, not healthy people, the more vulnerable populations easily succumbed during this time. Freed people died at terrible rates when they were freed during the war, but also at the end of the war, there was a huge sort of second round of deaths as freed people succumbed to disease, malnutrition, and froze to death in some cases after the war. So it was, and again, we don't have good numbers for that, but there were numbers of freed people who died after the war which were not insignificant compared to the death toll of the war. It was a huge, huge issue. There was one camp in Nashville, one freed person's camp in Nashville in 1864, where 25% of the freedmen died in that camp, right? So again, mainly children. Right, and older people, and we're talking about older people during this time. We're like 50 and up, right? We're talking about a different definition of what would be old. So for this reason, in the Civil War, and particularly in the South, everybody had to deal with death constantly, and how did they do this? How did they rethink death to try to make sense of these new situations? One thing they did is that they tried to recreate the ceremony and kind of rework the ceremony surrounding death in a way that would be applicable on the battlefield or even in refugee camps away from home. And so we can think of, when we think about a soldier's deaths and how soldiers' deaths are represented, there are certain ways in which soldiers try to recreate home deaths. Soldiers were often found holding pictures of family members, as to create a sort of a virtual domestic space. Nurses and chaplains would play the role of family members. There was a song that was very popular song that was sung during the Civil War that said, "Be my mother till I die." So where nurses would sit there and try to, say, "Let me be with you during your imminent death, and speak to me as though I am your sister or your mother." Soldiers wrote letters in case of their deaths, sometimes ahead of time. They'd write a letter and say, "Should I die, I would want for these to be seen as my last words, to hold the place of those words that I cannot say upon my death." Sometimes soldiers, as they were dying, were able to write letters. And so we have in the archives many, many letters written by dying soldiers to their families in which they recreate these ceremonies, right? There's a letter from a guy in Mississippi, a Mississippi soldier, who writes from Gettysburg, "I have time to write that I died like a man." Or a letter, a bloodstained letter from 1864, by a soldier whose arm had been amputated, but his death was imminent. And he says, death is inevitable. This is my last letter to you. I write to you because I know that you would be delighted to read a word from your dying son, right? And, you know, this idea that it's extremely important and reassuring to go through this ritual of death. And, of course, the nurses would take notes and write letters on behalf of soldiers who couldn't write themselves, should they be fortunate enough to have that time for the nurses to write the letter right before they died. In some cases, of course, there's no opportunity to do these things, right? There's no opportunity to write out a letter or have a nurse write out a letter. And so in order to try to compensate for some of this, they would do things like read the last expression on the face of the dead and say, from his last expression, we know that he was expecting salvation, right? You know, from his last expression, we know that he was resigned to his death, right? He looked happy and peaceful, right? They would say in the letters, right, in their last. Now, how honest were these letters, right? How honest were these letters? We know that they weren't always honest because people would then write to somebody else and say, I chose not to tell them. You know. So we have some evidence that these letters were not always honest. But we also have some very honest letters that say he was not ready for his death. You know, he had a bad death. You know, I need for you to know that he was not prepared for salvation. He was cursing God as he died, you know. So sometimes they would feel like it was that they were obligated to pass on that bad news as well. The other thing which when soldiers would write, they say, my friend died on the battlefield, write to the soldier's family, which was very common. You know, my friend died on the battlefield, your son. And he didn't have time. He died suddenly. He didn't have time to say anything. But I know that he was knowing that he was going to die. There is a strong belief in premonition. You know, in the last weeks of his life, he became a strong Christian. He talked a lot about death. He prepared himself for his death. So there came to be a very popular belief that soldiers have a long-term understanding of when their death is coming and therefore are able to do that kind of death work, even in case of a sudden death that they weren't. That they don't have time for the regular ritual. So what do people do with this religiously? And here's what I want to talk about sort of for the rest. I have a couple of images I want to show you, which I probably should have done before. Yes, so we have a couple of these images. These are just, you know, classic battlefield images. It's the first war that you're able to have these images from the battlefield. We won't talk too much about these images. But these deaths were not the kind of deaths that were these idealized, domestic, in your bed deaths. They were sudden and gory, and people were well aware of that. And this, I wanted to bring this up, the other part of a good death is that your body is memorialized. You know, that people know where you are. There's a ritual around your grave. Family members come to visit you. This is a very crucial part, right, of the memorialization of people's death, is the sort of respect for their body. And of course, in the Civil War, so many bodies were lost, right? But when somebody was, it was even more than today, I think. When somebody would die, people would, even soldiers on the battlefield, would stop and try to mark in some way the body. Right, you know, try to say I threw up a piece of wood with written in, I wrote in charcoal on a piece of wood the name of this person so that they would know. Right, people tried to mark themselves by having their name on their person somewhere, so that their death could be marked. And family members would go after the death of a loved one. They would go searching for the body for weeks. They would go out, get on a train, go down to the battlefield, walk around the battlefield, searching for these bodies, and then later going around the hospitals and trying to find clues so that they could recover the body of their loved one. rituals of mourning, you know, emerged around death, as a way to sort of recognize death, recognize the power of death, and to absorb death into the culture. This is just a mourning dress. There was a whole sort of all this mourning fashion just proliferated during the war. People, they ran out of black material. They didn't have enough black dress stuff to make their mourning dresses, right? And a lot of people, of course, particularly in the South, just didn't have any money because the economy had broken down. It was very important to get into your proper black mourning clothes, a very formal ritual of mourning. Okay, so how is it that religiously people began to think about death? Everybody isn't a Christian, right? But Christianity, and particularly in Protestant Christianity, were absolutely central to the culture. And mainly we'll be talking about that. But I wanted to mention first that some people started to embrace different traditions than Christianity, or to add on a little something, right, to Christianity. And that was spiritualism. So right before the Civil War, in the 1850s, there was an idea that you could communicate with the dead through seances, right? So this really emerged in the 1850s. You start having a pretty big spiritualist movement. Probably about 5% of the population were involved in seances, right? Listening to mediums and spirit talkers, right? Sort of interpret the words of the dead, right? What spiritualists believed was that when you died, you went to, there were actually several different levels of heaven. And each level of heaven was a little bit further separated from earth. So that when you're in the first level of heaven, you're basically just like yourself, but without your body. But you're just like yourself, sort of hanging out with the dead, the people who have passed on that you know. And kind of watching things that are going on the earth, because your interests are still with the earth. So you're just kind of up there observing what's going on. And you're interested in communicating with people on the earth. So if they simply know how to call upon you through these seances, that you'll be available to talk to them, right? So a lot of people, and a lot of very intelligent people, you know, a lot of very powerful people, major newspaper editors, major politicians, right, major intellectuals, in the 19th century, in the 1850s and 60s and 70s, attempted to communicate with their dead loved one through seances. And this had started before the war, right? But during the war, spiritualism became a great source of consolation for a lot of people who could communicate then with the dead soldiers and their families through this process of mediumship. There was a major newspaper called the Banner of Light, which was a spiritualist newspaper. The Banner of Light introduced a whole section, which was called a message department, which was things that the spirits wanted to communicate to people that ought to be put in the paper, right? And these were filled with messages from deceased soldiers, you know, about what it's like to die as a soldier, and you know, sort of communicating the nature of the afterworld, communicating the pain of death, which was very much, apparently, according to one, like an amputation. It hurt for a while, right? So there were these sort of efforts to try to communicate through spiritualism on the part of many. There's something called a planchette. If anybody's ever played with a Ouija board, right? The planchette was available in the 1850s, and you could hear the spirit when a medium could hear the spirit talking. They would they either had a board with the letters that they could go through, and the spirit could, you know, or you could ask questions, and the spirit in some cases would rap. You could hear yes, no, raps. But there's different ways. Or the spirit, in this case, this has a pencil, and it could write a message. So the medium could take this, and the spirit could guide the hand in writing a message from the loved one. Okay, but that was still a minority view, right? And most people turned to Protestant Christianity. And Protestant Christianity had a lot of condolence to offer to the victims or the bereaved. Protestant Christianity, first of all, turned to this question of the broader war aims, right? This question of maybe the war itself is part of God's plan, maybe, and this is something I'm sure you'll be talking about next week, but the war itself is God's plan, and your death is part of God's greater plan for the world. It's not without without its meaning. The Christian, according to many ministers, the Christian is the perfect soldier. The Christian is the efficient soldier, right? Because a Christian does not fear death, because the Christian knows that death is just a step into salvation. And so God has created these Christians so they can be part of executing his greater plan for the world. As one minister said, there is a need to wind up and settle this great tragedy in a way to exactly justify every drop of blood that has been shed in it. The meaning of what we've done must justify the deaths of our many, many loved ones. Okay? So you could talk about it like that. But you could also talk about death as part of the personal plan of the deceased. Right? And that's where you think about the work at the time of death, even before the war, of sort of re-narratizing, sort of rewriting the meaning of the life of the person who's deceased so that their death at this moment has a meaning. Their death, it could have been in no other way. They needed to die at this moment because they were particularly prepared to die at this moment. Their death at this moment fulfilled something they've been working for in their life. It was the right ending of their story, right? And largely what ministers did in comforting the bereaved was that they both put their death in the context of this greater good, right, of God's plan, right, but also put this death in the context of their own personal narrative of salvation, right, and their own sort of personal narrative of meaning. Death is never premature, but always comes at exactly the right time in accordance with God's design. No, they don't. They don't. I'm going to say, some of them did, right? Predestination is... pretty much is very weakened by this point. Calvinism is really off to the side by this moment. Less so among the Presbyterians, right? But in general, in Protestant Christianity, predestination is really weakened. Nobody's speaking the language of predestination, you know. So it's not exact. It's not predestination, but it's God's plan unfolding. Right, it's God's plan unfolding. So it's a bit of a distinction, but not exactly predestination. They wouldn't have said that. Most of them wouldn't have said that. Okay, but the other important thing that happens, and the thing that changes in the way that people look at death at this time, is that a sort of denial of the reality of death, or the denial of the significance of death, by a rewriting of heaven. As one reverend said, what is death? It is the middle point between two lives, right? Or there's a Confederate tract that circulates that says, why will ye die? Why do you choose to die, right? Why will ye die? And it's the idea is that death, if a Christian death, is not a death, but it's just a transition into the life in heaven, in some ways very similar to the sort of spiritualist conception. And also similar because the idea of heaven has been really rewritten in the 19th century. So in the 18th century, it was very common to think about heaven as a pretty abstract place, right, where everybody worships God, right? There's some, in some sense, you're up there worshiping God. But heaven is sort of about where you can, in an abstract way, you know, be closer to and sort of, you know, communing with, closely with God. What happens, and this partially is Emanuel Swedenborg, who starts this whole thing, you know, back then. But what happens is by the 19th century, it becomes more and more common to see heaven as a place that's very, very, very similar to earth, right? Heaven is a place where your relationships to people, not only are you in heaven worshiping God, all the people you know are in heaven around you. You're in a house, very similar to your own house. You might have a piano, right? You might have some books. Right, and that they start to imagine, particularly in the Civil War period, they start to imagine heaven as a place where everything is exactly replicated, except better. It's always daytime. You know, it's always daytime and nobody is sick, right? And there's a sort of perfection. But it's a sort of heaven as a place where you, all of your loved ones, and maybe even all of the things you love, right, will be up there with you in the afterlife. And that is something which was already emerging before the Civil War, but really strengthens with the Civil War. There's a writer named Elizabeth Stuart Phelps who writes right after the end of the war. Her brother has died in the war. And she writes a book called The Gates Ajar, which is one of the best-selling books of the 19th century. And it's about what heaven is like, right? And she says, we desire the dead to be reunited with us, not only to look at, standing up among the singers, as an angel with a harp, but close to us, somewhere or another near us, right? As near as they were, really ours again, right? So she says, we don't want to imagine the death in some abstract way, praising God with a harp. We want to imagine that they will be intimate with us again. And in this sort of 19th century changing vision of heaven, which is then represented in all sorts of, you know, sheet music, all sorts of popular songs, all sorts of poems, all sorts of stories, all sorts of images, right? That there's this idea that heaven is a sort of shining, glowing home. Right, heaven is a home with a family, right? And so part of what happens is we sort of, to deal with this, sort of we place our soldiers after death back in the home that they couldn't be in at the moment of death, to sort of console that, console ourselves for that loss. So to kind of wrap up here, so one thing that I think is happening in 19th century religion and that Civil War really speeds up, right, is this sort of secularization, and not in a bad way, but like, or it could be in a bad way, right, but this sort of making religious language much more continuous with our sort of secular structures, right? And all sorts of things are going to come in the wake of that. One thing that's going to happen right after the Civil War is the social gospel movement, which really says, if you want to be a Christian, what the most important thing you have to do if you want to be a Christian is help, you know, is to be charitable and to be, you know, work on reforming and improving those around you, right? So this idea that social service is central to people in this world, right, are central to Christianity more so than prayer, right, more so than, you know, biblical activities, right? Things like that. That's going to be emerging in the, like within the couple decades after the Civil War. The idea of collective salvation, which is also tied to the social gospel movement, but becomes really big right after the Civil War. That is, none of us are saved alone, right? That our salvation really has to come through bringing about a Christian society, right? You know, I think is starting to sort of emerge, you know, at this time. And part of that then is also religious nationalism, right, which is something which is going to be on the increase starting with the Civil War, but really is going to increase up through World War II at least, right? This idea of religious nationalism, that the things that happen, you know, politically and sort of on the ground in our nation are the very same, right, as our sort of theological, our theological work. These things cannot be disentangled with one another. So the Civil War and the terrible deaths of the Civil War help us to rethink the meaning of death and the relationship between the sort of holy and the secular. So I'd be happy to take questions from anybody about anything death-related. Yes. Yeah. Specifically clergy. So a lot of clergy went off and became, attached themselves to military units, right? And were there, chaplains on the field, often in the hospitals, in the field hospitals or out on the battlefield. They often did a lot of this work of communicating back with families. You know, I could have put them right in there with the nurses. They often were the ones who would write a letter back back home, they, there was a unit that I just read about, a great book by somebody actually in Pittsburgh, Leslie Gordon, wrote a great book about a terrible unit in Connecticut that sort of failed at everything. They ran away at Antietam, you know, they're like, but, and then they were taken prisoner, and many of them died in prison. And one of their numbers had been a clergyman. One of the people who was taken to Andersonville had been a clergyman, and it was his job that he gave himself to record the names and fates of each of the members of the unit so that when he was finally released, that he could account for all their deaths to their family members. So clergy sort of saw themselves as it's a ritual process, right? You know, helping them to do this work of integrating this death. So they prepared the soldiers at the time of death, but they also helped to prepare to help the family members.
Catholics, I think, were,
yes.
You know, immigrants.
Yes, many, yeah.
Did they have to have the last rites on the battlefield?
Well, they would have, yes, they had to have last rites on the battlefield. Right, but they couldn't have last rites. I mean, there just weren't enough Catholic clergy. There were some Catholic units that had Catholic clergy that could give those last rites. I don't know whether Protestant clergymen would somehow substitute for try to do it, but I think that would be no theologically. I don't think that it would be wrong for them to even attempt. Right. So I'm pretty sure that a Catholic clergyman. So if you're like in a New York regiment, like a New York City regiment, something like that, right? You're going to have a Catholic priest as your clergyman, and they could do that. But if you just happen to be a Catholic, like say you're from a Memphis resident where they have a lot of Catholics, right? But not enough that they would have the clergyman. You wouldn't have access to that. Yeah, that's a really good question because I wonder how they talked about that. I mean, did the church then take the position that too bad this guy, you do wonder like how they consoled the family to say you get an exception.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually don't know that. That's a really interesting question.
Do we know what the predominant denomination at the time was?
Okay. So the big denominations, at this time, I think Baptist and Methodist by the 1850s were the two biggest denominations nationally. After, because this is the Second Great Awakening, there's a lot of Presbyterians, right? There's a substantial number of Lutherans. There's going to be some Episcopalians. I can't see who'd be bigger than the Baptist. Yeah, Baptist and Methodist would be the two biggest. I'm going to say that with confidence, that it's the Baptist and the Methodist, particularly in the South. Right, but I think even in the North, the Baptists and Methodists would, by this point, have been predominant. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier about the memorialization of graves and that kind of thing. If a soldier cannot be returned, wasn't identified or whatnot, or there was a possibility on the battlefield about getting the body back home, what happened back home? Did they go ahead and have a grave?
Yeah, well, first of all, often they just never stop looking for the body. There's these terrible stories of, people who years after the war are still writing to all these officials and saying, I need to find, the body of my son. Or, and often people didn't, not only did they not get the body, they didn't get an official report that the person had been killed, right? That nobody even the army didn't know that they had been killed, right? And so often it was a terrible situation where you just, you try to get notes from letters from people who are in their unit. Where is this person? Have they been captured or killed? Have they been lost? Are they sick somewhere and unable to write? You just didn't know. And then it took a couple of years before you had to finally say, okay, I guess that my loved one, must have died. So in many cases, when you couldn't find the body, or even you weren't sure if there was a body, right? You couldn't have that. Did people set up? Some people set up, ended up setting up memorials, in the absence of a body. But often you just had that terrible absence of that ritual, you know, and eventually a widow would remarry, you know. But that was the most terrible fate, was not being able to what you call today closure on that. Yeah, no, that's right.
At that time, were there cremations, or was everything buried?
There were cremations at that time. Actually, there's some really, really interesting work about... There's a lot of work right now on death, right, in this period. So it's hard to even keep up with all of it. But a lot of people were really interested in keeping the body for the first time. So there had been this idea that the body should become part of nature again, right? The body should deteriorate and sort of become part of nature again, and that was the expectation when you buried them. You bury them in a coffin, and so the process would take longer, right? But there wasn't an idea, really, before the 19th century that your body should somehow always remain, have integrity, right? And in the 19th century, you do start having cremation. I can't put the exact time on that, but certainly by 1840s, 1850s, people are being cremated. And part of the point of cremation was that then the body can be contained in this vessel, and this vessel could be kept in much better shape, right? And could always be kept with a sort of integrity that the body itself couldn't have. But this is a moment when there's efforts to build coffins that are going to be less permeable, right? Even like there'd be sort of places where you could place ashes collectively, and they would have little boxes, you know, almost like a bric-a-brac shelf, right? So each person would have, you know, each thing would have its own sort of space. So, I mean, there's some really interesting cultural work on how it is that we want to sort bodies and sort of keep them individual after death. And cremation is a really important part of that process, because even though it destroys the body, it also enables the body to remain, you know, together permanently in one place. Sorry, this is so, I kind of like, but yeah.
I read somewhere that Lincoln's body was to protect it from whatever might occur to his body being so venerated that
yes.
It was encased in lead or something. Do you know anything about that?
Well, there's embalming during this period, right? So, but he I actually don't. He must have had a special. He may well have had a special coffin. But this is also the period when we start to embalm the bodies. So that they will stay. We finally have the technology to try to keep the bodies. There was a terrible sort of unsuccessful embalming of Stonewall Jackson, you know, where they thought they could sort of ship him around and show off his body everywhere, but it turns out they hadn't done a good enough job with the embalming. But Lincoln, they're really, really interested in, keeping that body as a permanent symbol. I'm sure he was embalmed. And it makes a lot of sense to me they put in a lead coffin, though I actually didn't know that detail. Yeah. Yeah.
So the death rituals in the slave families must have been very different, correct?
Yes, they must have been so. So what do we know about slave deaths? Part of what happened with slave deaths is they don't obviously have the luxury there's a couple things. They don't have the luxury of... controlling, you know, what their rituals are going to be often, particularly at times of so slaves who died after the war in these terrible freedmen camps, part of the problem was that, and part of the horror of these slave deaths is that often their bodies were just like eaten, you know, by rats or like, you know, that was one of the things that missionaries were complaining about, was that the freed people were not given the resources to. They were hustled away. They weren't allowed to take the dead with them. You know, they didn't have the ability, the resources to, particularly if they were in these refugee camps, right, to bury the dead. And so there were all these reports back from missionaries about the horrible condition of the dead bodies. So part of it is that freed people didn't have the ability to do that. But as far as like what kind of rituals did they have? I mean, and the other thing is that. Because slaves and freed people, one thing that had been taken away from them was their common culture. They don't have a way of communicating a culture to each other through newspapers, as whites did, right? So there's going to be less there's going to be less continuity between funerary processes of slaves and freed people than between whites, because they don't have that way of planning it together. But yeah, they're, you know, most slaves by this point are Christian, right? And so they're going to be doing some version of the same sort of Christian ceremony with maybe elements of African, you know, ritual. Yeah, coming back. Yeah.
Did the government have any means to identify dog tags, for instance?
Yeah, they didn't have the dog tags, and that's why you have a lot of people privately pinning things to themselves, you know, things like that. Maybe about something in the North that was more official, like I think, you know, that, but I kind of don't think so. I think, and so you have a lot of people writing their names, particularly in those last wars, or the last battles in the very end of the war. People were, you know, writing down their names on papers, sticking them in their pockets, you know, doing things like that so that people could mark them. But yeah, many, many people never were identified. I mean, think about it, like the technology of how you could have like a dog tag or something like that. I don't know if they would even, we'll have to think about that. If they even sort of technologically had a really good way of doing that, other than just putting it on paper. But maybe they would have, like a cardboard or something like that. But they wouldn't have been able to do, could they have done, I'm trying to think, could they have done printing on metal or, you know, something like that? They could have had something wooden. Yeah. Well, that's what they did with the first dog tags, too, didn't they? Those were stamped. So maybe they could have done something like that, but no. Yeah. I don't think so. I've certainly never seen a Civil War dog tag. I'm sure that would have been like that. That would be, if there were Civil War dog tags, we all would have seen like 100,000 of them, because that would be the first thing in all the museums. Right? So I think we could say definitively no. Yeah. So.
What were the rituals of the widows other than wearing black?
Other than wearing black. Well, and that was, wearing black was an elaborate ritual, right? Because there was like, it wasn't just you wore black, it's that you were first in full mourning, depending on what the relationship of the person to you was, right? You know, if you're a widow, you're first in full mourning for, I think it was a year, maybe 2 years, something like that. Then you're in half mourning, then you're like in like partial mourning, you have like something black on you, right? But you do things like, in addition to wearing black, you would put black around the borders of all of your letters that you sent. You'd draw like black in this marker, you know, around every letter that you sent to indicate that you're in mourning. There wasn't a, it wasn't that you couldn't, well, you could choose not to go out if you're a widow. You could say, I can't be seen in public. It would be inappropriate for you to go to a big party, right, or something like that, if you were a new widow, right? But as you could see from some of those widow's outfits that we showed before, you know, some of them were for outdoor, you know, various occasions, like, you know, you would need to have a widow outfit to go riding. You know, you need to have a widow outfit to go out for a stroll. You know, a widow outfit for evening wear, right? So they expect that you're going to be doing those things during your period of even full mourning. You would try to put yourself back into life gradually. There were 2 years of full mourning for a widow. I want to say there's 2 years of full mourning for a widow, and then it drops back. And there were something like 3 months for a man. It was like for a widower, it's like 3 or 4 months. I can't remember which one it is, but it was like they had to like put like a weed in their hair or something, you know. But it was like, you know, it's a little bit different, you know. But I'm going to say 2 years. It's possible as one, but I believe it was 2 years for full mourning for widows, and then you drop back into half mourning. And it would be inappropriate to marry, you know, during that time, though people did it, and particularly during the Civil War. You know, a lot of these traditions were less. Yeah.
It never occurred to me, along with those pictures, what if you were poor, or it occurred to me those cost a fair amount of money.
Yeah.
Dressed like that, so those rules apply to the border, or?
Well, there, you know, one thing benevolent associations would do is raise money to help poor widows be in mourning. So you would get some money from a church or something to help with your mourning. But yeah, you wouldn't be wearing that kind of clothing anyway if you were poor. So, you know, you're not a, I mean, one of the shames of being poor is that you can't do the socially appropriate things. So, yeah.
I want to ask a question about Abraham Lincoln. You mentioned about the way people thought about the Civil War as part of God's plan. How did he see it? I mean, did he see it as a political, this will the only way we can hold the nation together, or did he really have a theological understanding of it as part of God's plan for, you know, a big plan?
I think this is, I'm going to be cutting into David's, is this next week? Is this your next week? But, yeah. That's going to be his thing, which doesn't mean that, like, yeah. But I'm almost hesitant to talk about it, because I'm really a cultural historian. I think he might know more about it than I do. I, what I'm interested in is like the people and like what it is they think about this and that. So I have Les Lincoln. Okay. Yeah.
That's fine. I came across, he actually wrote a short piece that ended up in John Casey and Meditation on God's Providence. I don't remember how we read that.
Okay, we can wait for next week.
I might even see if I can come back next week. Like, when I'm picking up a little bit more Lincoln. So, okay, and yeah. I actually don't even know about the Jewish custom during the Civil War. I mean, all I can say is that there were a few rabbis who were out serving as clergy, right? There were a couple of rabbis. But in general, obviously, there almost nowhere was there enough of a collection of Jewish soldiers that they had their own, you know, rabbi traveling with them. So Jewish people would have to, you know, be on their own. Which is particularly a problem with Judaism, particularly before Reform Judaism, right? Because so many of the rituals are absolutely dependent upon a present community. So even, you know, even more than Christians, I think that within Judaism, a lot of the rituals can't work, right? You know, unless you have a community present. Yeah, so that would be a real issue. I'm not sure about the stones, but I can only imagine that they would have, like Christians, kept from their normal ritual practices, that there would be some sort of way to approximate that through these, you know, individual practices. Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Yeah.
When did the military first start using chaplains?
I don't know. They had them during the Civil War.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. The Mexican War was such a mess. I can't imagine they even got around to having chaplains in the Mexican War, but maybe they did.
I want to say they started in the Civil War, but I'm not sure.
Well, I can, you know, so I read a certain amount about the Mexican War, and I can't remember having ever, you know, and I've read a lot of their primary sources from the Mexican War. I can't remember hearing reference to a chaplain. So it's possible it started in the Civil War, but I'm not going to be, I mean, in some way, there would have been some approximate, you know, it's not going to be like, oh, there were no religious presence in the Mexican War. But I'm not sure if there was an official, if there was an expectation of a chaplain attached to each unit. I feel like the Mexican War was so disorganized that, you know, they almost wouldn't have. It wasn't as carefully sort of iterated as later wars, and certainly like Indian Wars, you know, things like that. Most of the soldiers are out there who are fighting before this time are fighting in various Indian Wars or Seminole War, stuff like that. They wouldn't have had chaplains down, you know, with the Seminole War. So I would think that the Mexican War would have followed that pattern. And not had chaplains. So that's just, yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.